This morning is J.B. against Woodard, and we will begin with you, Mr. Bush.
Thank you, Your Honor. Edwin Bush, on behalf of myself and next friend of the minor children, J.B. and A.B., I'm representing myself. I do not envy this position. There was a series of cases in this area of law that were adjudicated starting about 20 years ago, and in the last 5 years, these cases have stopped being brought. The outfit bringing these was acquired by another outfit. So this area of law is established, but it hasn't been litigated very often. It involves the issue of Illinois DCFS safety plans. Safety plans were a subject of suit in Dupuy versus Samuels, in which Judge Pallmeyer in 2003 entered an injunction against this practice. A safety plan is a quote unquote voluntary agreement by a parent to not be with their children for a period of time during an investigation. And it's been represented to these courts for years that these quote unquote safety plans are voluntary. The plaintiffs throughout the years have consistently claimed that these agreements are not voluntary. Now, this is the first case to ever come before this court involving a safety plan in which it was refused. And I refused the safety plan on October 3rd, 2018. And then what occurred after that was a series of retaliation and then interfering in an ongoing civil domestic relations case.
But Mr. Bush, am I correct, though, that when you did refuse it, nothing happened right away? You continued to have the children on that particular date.
That is correct, Your Honor. And in fact, there was a well-being check that occurred later in which a responding officer for the Cook County Sheriff's Department said the children are fine and took no action. So there was no dispute.
And Mr. Bush, if I could just clarify, please, I didn't see anything in your complaint that the children knew about the proposed safety plan or knew about the defendant's attempt to get you to agree to enter into the safety plan. Is that correct?
Well, actually, both of the children were present in my right here in my living room when the conversation was occurring a few feet away from me in my kitchen. So the children were there, but at the time the child was seven and the other one was three. So they really had no idea what was going on. Exhibit A of the complaint has the transcript in which JB was a part of this conversation or this incident for a period on October 3rd, 2018. But whether the children knew what in fact was occurring, I highly dispute. I don't think that they were aware of what was occurring.
So I wonder if you could summarize, Mr. Bush, what concrete things happened as a result of the DCF officers versus what concrete things happened as a result of orders of the state court?
Yes, thank you for that, Your Honor. Well, first, count three is a procedural due process claim, which, in fact, the act of asking for a safety plan was, in fact, a due process violation.
Why was that a due process violation on a procedural side? Doesn't that just begin a set of procedures?
Because they agreed in a federal settlement agreement in 2016 before Judge Feinerman, it's called the AB et al. Versus Holloman et al. Case, that they can't even ask for a safety plan without first having grounds to take protective custody, because that act itself is coercive. That they're trying to get a party to coercively agree to something that the state has no legal basis.
I understand you have objections to it, but I'm trying to zero in on why that's particularly a procedural due process, a constitutional violation. Perhaps, you know, you would go back in and seek enforcement of the settlement agreement or the consent decree, but every violation of a consent decree isn't ipso facto a due process violation.
Well, the you know, I believe that when the state settled the AB versus Holloman complaint, it was the AB versus Holloman complaint was a procedural due process claim and arguing that, in fact, their due process rights under the law and substantive due process rights were infringed by that practice, in which in that case, the parties agreed. Now, again, as the court is indicating, in this case, I did not agree. But what they did after that is they took retaliatory steps and interjected themselves into the domestic relations case, recommending that I have supervised parenting time with both of my children before they unfounded the allegation, resulting in an emergency order protection.
Can you explain how we could give you relief without overriding orders of the state court?
Well, that's an excellent question, because first of all, the emergency order protection was a temporary order. It was only in effect from October 10th, 2018 until November 30th, 2018. And then the what the state argued in the district court is that the court should abstain because there was a judgment in effect, a state court judgment that was ultimately vacated by the state appellate court. And that, in fact, the judgment was vacated by the state appellate court before a month before Judge Johnson Coleman dismissed the case under Younger. So
Mr. Bush, are you claiming, and I'm sorry to interrupt, are you claiming that your injury stemmed from the emergency order of protection and the other orders entered by the state court before the appellate court vacated those?
Yes, and I'm relying on Brokaw versus Weaver, number one, a case from 2003, in which the alleged constitutional injury occurred before the state court judgment was entered, and then also that there was no prior opportunity to raise that matter in the underlying state proceeding. That count two is a substantive due process violation. The other part of the procedural due process violation is that the state
Mr. Bush, I just want to clarify. So mm-hmm. It's not the final judgment necessarily that was ultimately reversed and sent back on, but these interim orders.
Yes, there were temporary orders that are no longer in effect.
And those are the ones that you're claiming violated your substantive due process rights.
Yes, and that is correct, is that those orders that were entered on the basis, and it's in the record, that my ejection of the DCFS worker was the basis to enter these temporary orders.
And the first one is the October 10th, 2018?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, thank you.
And then it was actually continued on November 30th. There was a temporary order entered that was not set for hearing. It was a orders sua sponte entered by the state court judge.
I think Judge Scudder has a question for you.
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
No problem. Did you want to finish your thought?
No, sir.
Okay. Can I tell you how I read, in essence, your allegations? And you can tell me whether I've interpreted them correctly or not.
Mm-hmm.
If you look, for example, in paragraph 147 of the complaint you filed in federal court.
Okay.
The very last portion of that, what you're effectively saying, as I read it, is that what Miss, is it Woodard started, or Woodard engaged in on October the 3rd of 2018 with requesting or insisting upon the safety plan, touched off a series of events that then occurred over the course of 8 months, and in other places you say and are continuing to this date, that
true.
Have violated your federal constitutional rights, your right to procedural due process and substantive due process.
Yes, sir.
Is that a fair summary?
That is actually an extraordinarily fair summary of what occurred, and I'm relying on Brokaw versus Mercer County, which was a landmark case from this circuit, issued by Judge Mannion in 2000, relied on Morris versus Dearborn, which was a Fifth Circuit case from 1999, which stated that the unwitting decisions of a state court judge does not excuse liability under 42 USC 1983's causation doctrine.
Okay.
So yes, that's absolutely correct. And the act of the state not bringing a juvenile court action, the state has the authority to bring actions in juvenile court. And in juvenile court, I have procedural due process protections. And when the state interjected itself in the domestic relations case, wrote emails to the opposing counsel and made prejudicial recommendations that there should be supervised parenting time and a counseling session, ordered counseling, which ended up not being admissible under the state Marriage and Dissolution of Marriage Act. So I went to a counseling session to get my parenting time back, and I couldn't use that session because under the Marriage Act, that session was confidential and privileged and couldn't be used in any matter in litigation. So they absolutely set off a chain of events, crossed their jurisdictional boundaries into a civil case in which they have no jurisdiction, investigating an allegation that was 2 months old that originated in Wisconsin. Which they ultimately unfounded.
Your time has expired, Mr. Bush, unless one of the judges has any further questions. All right, thank you very much. Mr. Griffiths.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the court, Assistant Attorney General Carson Griffiths on behalf of defendants. Plaintiff's complaint raised three claims under Section 1983. Count one was a challenge to a Illinois statute, Section 607.6D. of the Illinois Marriage and Dissolution of Marriage Act, and counts two and three raise substantive and procedural due process claims, respectively. I'd like to begin with counts two and three and why the district court's dismissal of those counts was proper.
Mr. Griffiths, before you do that, can I ask you a question that may help frame this? Where does everything stand today in these matters by your understanding in the state courts?
By my understanding in the state courts, the Illinois Appellate Court remanded for a final resolution of the parenting time issue, the custody issue, essentially. And then there were delays in those proceedings because of COVID and other issues. There was an emergency order of protection filed by Mr. Bush's ex-spouse, and that was granted a motion for an order of emergency protection, which was granted. And then there was an interlocutory appeal back to the Illinois Appellate Court on that emergency order of protection, which was affirmed. And as it stands now, I believe that the ultimate conclusion as to parenting time is still awaiting a decision in the Domestic Relations Court.
Yeah, there's not been a final adjudication, and Mr. Bush is awaiting further decision or final decision for that matter.
Yes, although I would note that because domestic relations proceedings are somewhat unique in that there's continual circuit court involvement with custody issues, the original February 2019 judgment here was considered final and appealable by the Appellate Court. So that was considered a final judgment. And then they said, well, it's a final judgment, but what the Appellate Court should have, basically, it just made a mistake, the circuit court, and it should have fully decided the issue of parenting time rather than entering essentially a conditional suspension of parenting time.
Okay, thank you.
But turning back to counts two and three, the district court abstained under Younger, and I'm happy to answer any questions about the application of Younger here, but I would like to focus my remarks today on the alternative basis that the domestic relations exception to federal jurisdiction barred plaintiff's
claim. Seem to almost concede, but not totally, that Younger doesn't apply here. Is that a fair reading of your briefs? At least
no, Your Honor,
substantive and procedural due process claims.
No, Your Honor, I don't concede that they don't apply. I do concede to the extent that the district court dismissed Mr. Bush's claims for damages specifically, that a stay would have been more appropriate under Younger and the U.S. Supreme Court's precedent rather than a dismissal. So to that extent, I do. But I believe that the request for declaratory injunctive relief in all three counts, there are requests for declaratory judgment in counts two and three, but those were properly stayed under Younger because they would interfere with future domestic relations proceedings.
But why is that consistent with Sprint? I mean, I don't want to maybe beat a dead horse if you're not really relying on it, but if you are still relying on it, it seems like a bad fit for Younger. It's not a case brought by the state. It's not like Giudice against Vail, where the state is protecting its contempt powers, for example. There's no criminal proceeding, and on and on. It's a private dispute between two parties. Now, if you're going to start going into the weeds of abstention doctrines, there are other abstention doctrines that address more specifically comprehensive state schemes of regulation, whether you're thinking of Burford or whether you're thinking of Colorado River, but nobody's arguing anything about that in this case.
Yes, Your Honor, I recognize it's not a perfect fit under Sprint and the factors set out there. I would note that this year in Kruger versus Call, which is cited in our brief, this court did apply Younger to a privately initiated paternity dispute. But other than that, I would rest on our briefs on Younger. And with the remaining time I have, I'd like to focus on the domestic relations.
Yeah, you can look at the domestic. I have to say, I think it may not be the best fit for the domestic relations exception either. There we have the Supreme Court's Ankenbrand case. But this is the claim as brought by the plaintiff is a federal constitutional claim. And yes, it will have an indirect impact on a domestic relations case, but it's not going to create custody. It's not going to dissolve a marriage. It's not going to do anything.
Well, Your Honor, I'd like to point you to three decisions where this court has held that the exception precludes challenges to state domestic relations orders, even if they are presented under the guise of a federal constitutional claim. So first, the Winehouse case cited in our brief, this court held that a federal due process claim premised on the notion that a custody order deprived the plaintiff of due process was barred by the domestic relations exception. In Allen, this court held that a federal constitutional claims for damages, like Mr. Bush's claim, that were allegedly caused by a visitation order were barred by the domestic relations exception. And in Jones, which was a case involving the probate exception, but which is coextensive with the domestic relations exception. That was a claim that a guardian provided false information to the probate judge, which led the probate judge to entering an order that violated the plaintiff's due process rights. Very similar to what we have here today, as Mr. Bush recognized in his opening comments. He has recognized that the state court's order is what caused the due process violation here. And as Judge Scudder noted in the complaint, that is what the complaint says as well. I would also point out that on page 24 of plaintiff's memorandum in opposition to our motion to dismiss, he expressly states that, quote, plaintiff's familial rights claim does not rest on defendant's failed unlawful attempt to enter a safety plan. So it's not defendant's conduct independent of the court's order that Mr. Bush is challenging here. He is challenging the court's order itself. And that's what sets this case firmly within the bounds of the domestic relations exception.
But he also argues, although he didn't just now, but he spent a lot of time in his briefs arguing that actually the root cause of the problem is this Illinois statute that forbids people from using anything that was said in a counseling session. There are statements made in that counseling session that I won't outline, but that he would like to use. And so he says, well, no, I'm not attacking the state court order. I'm attacking this statute, 5/607.6D.
Right, Your Honor. And that was dismissed by the district court correctly on the grounds that there was no standing to pursue it against Mr. Smith, DCFS's director. And that's count one of the complaint brought only against Mr. Smith. And the district court correctly concluded that both Mr. Bush could not establish the causation element of Article III standing, nor could he establish the redressability element, because at base, Mr. Smith had no role in enforcing that statute. DCFS was not a party to the underlying domestic relations proceedings, and plaintiffs' own allegations in the complaint and in their brief, their statements in the brief, make clear that the state court and not DCFS enforced that provision. Note at page 44 of their opening brief, they say the state court enforced the provision, not DCFS. And so, for one, he cannot show that his injury was fairly traceable to any actions by Mr. Smith or DCFS as an entity. And also, for that same reason, he can't show that an injunction entered against DCFS would redress his injury. Ms. Bush and the state domestic relations court could still raise objections under 607.6D and exclude evidence under that statute, respectively, in future proceedings. The injunction would simply bind DCFS, which again is not a party to those proceedings. And I think the district court correctly relied on this court's decision in Holcomb, where there was in fact a more direct connection between the Indiana officials involved with the name change process in Indiana and Mr. Smith's connection to Section 607.6D here. And I'd also like to point out with respect to Mr. Bush's arguments that a lack of standing would deprive him of a forum in which he could challenge the statute. That's incorrect. He could, of course, challenge the application of the statute in the context of his state domestic relations proceedings. you could argue on an appeal. And in fact, in his brief, he says that he did argue on an appeal that the statute was unconstitutionally applied to him and he was deprived of a fair hearing because of his inability to introduce his son's statements. So unless this court has any other questions, we ask that you, for those reasons and the reasons stated in our brief as well, we ask that you affirm the district court's judgment. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Mr. Bush, your time expired, but I'll give you a minute to rebut.
Your Honor, just briefly on the issue of Younger, the issue of whether Younger applies to private domestic relations proceedings was, I believe, squarely addressed by Judge Posner in Link versus LaPorte Superior Court, number 2, 1986. I included that citation in both my opening and reply brief. The reference to Kruger versus Call, Mr. Griffith completely misrepresents that holding, in which it was the first time that I'm aware of that this court cited Sprint in holding that Younger does not apply to, in that case, a paternity case. So the unpublished Kruger versus Call case from 2000 supports this. In the Winehouse case, there was an order entered that barred a Missouri resident from having parenting time with his children in Illinois, and he sought to change the custody order. And so that's why the domestic relations exception was held to apply in that case. It's distinguishable from this case. Okay. And again, there's no court order that I'm...
You're going to have to wrap up now. Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor.
All right. Thank you very much. Thanks to both counsel. We'll take the case under advisement.